Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
I know, you can't wait. It's Fed Minutes Day. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, April 6th. Good to have you with us. Remember back on Monday, I started with the news for Wednesday? Come on, I know you were listening. Well, here we are. The minutes from the last meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee a few weeks ago came out today, and they give us a peek behind the curtain at what Fed officials were thinking when they voted to raise short-term interest rates by 0.25%. Many participants in the meeting thought 0.5% increases would be necessary later this year. But raising interest rates is only one tool in the Fed's arsenal. It can also raise and lower the temperature of the economy by buying and selling bonds, some issued by the Treasury, others backed by mortgages. The central bank has purchased more than $4.5 trillion worth of those assets since the pandemic sank the economy in March of 2020. The minutes suggest the Fed will start getting rid of those bonds to the tune of $95 billion a month. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains.
The Fed isn't just an arbiter of interest rates or a banking regulator. It's also kind of a bank itself.
One way to think of it is it has a balance sheet with assets on one side and liabilities on another.
That's Tim Dewey, an economics professor at the University of Oregon. Ever since the financial crisis in 2008, Dewey says the Fed's been filling up its balance sheet with trillions of dollars worth of government bonds and mortgage-backed securities.
As a mechanism by which it hoped to stimulate more economic activity.
That's because when the Fed buys government bonds, it reduces the supply of them on the market.
And so by pulling those assets off the market, financial markets have to find other assets and thereby push up the values of those assets.
At the same time, when the Fed buys bonds, it also increases demand for them, by definition. That can also stimulate the economy, says Winnie Caesar, global head of strategy for credit sites.
So if you have more demand, that means that prices are going to be higher and yields are going to be lower, and that lowers interest rates.
Lower interest rates and lots of liquidity in the economy are great when the Fed's trying to spur a recovery. But now the economy is overheating. So last month, the Fed stopped buying bonds. As a result, Caesar says,
it means there is one fewer very large buyer, which means that other investors are going to have to step in and absorb whatever supply is available.
Reduced demand and increased supply mean lower bond prices, and that in turn means higher interest rates, says Guy Labat, chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
They're intentionally causing financial conditions to get less good, get worse.
In other words, the Fed is making it a little harder for consumers and businesses to spend, turning down the temperature of the economy, with the hope of reining in inflation and loosening the tight labor market. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you should see the dip just after 2 p.m. Eastern when those minutes came out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Biden administration announced new sanctions today against Russia, targeting Russian banks, members of government and their families, and preventing Americans from investing in the country. The move is part of a coordinated international response to alleged atrocities committed by Russian soldiers. When Russia began its invasion of Ukraine, more than 30,000 Ukrainian nationals were here in the United States, either as tourists or without any documentation that would give them the right to work. There are also tens of thousands of Afghans in that same boat, many of whom were evacuated from their country last summer when it fell to the Taliban. Both groups are about to get the chance to stay in the U.S. legally and enter the job market by applying for temporary protected status. Marketplace's Samantha Fields looked into what that protection will and won't do for people who've fled violence in their homelands.
There are more than 300,000 people currently living in the U.S. under temporary protected status.
TPS is provided to nationals of specifically designated countries.
Allison Norris is an immigration lawyer with Catholic Charities in D.C.
Typically because of an ongoing armed conflict or environmental disaster.
Once the Department of Homeland Security designates a country for TPS, like it just did for Ukraine and Afghanistan, Norris says anyone from that country who was already in the U.S. can apply. It's usually good for a year and a half at most.
It can be extended, but it's typically in chunks of 18 months.
About a dozen countries have TPS right now, including South Sudan, Haiti, Syria, and El Salvador. Some have had it renewed over and over again for years.
One that immediately comes to mind is El Salvador, which has had it since at least 2001. These are folks who have been renewing their status every 18 months for two decades in some situations.
Which means a lot of people with TPS are living in a perpetual state of limbo.
But for those who qualify, who had typically been living here without authorization, it's a tremendous benefit, but it is limited.
Hassan Shafiqullah, an immigration attorney at Legal Aid in New York, says TPS gives people a work permit and protection from deportation, but that's pretty much it. Unlike refugees or people who have asylum, if you have TPS, you can't get federal housing assistance or Medicaid.
You cannot get food stamps. You cannot get Social Security, you know, or SSI, Supplemental Security Income benefits. Most benefits you're not going to be eligible for. And it doesn't lead to a green card.
Having TPS doesn't prevent someone from getting a green card another way, through family or work or by getting asylum. But TPS itself is not a path to citizenship, no matter how long someone's had it. Allison Norris at Catholic Charities says that makes it really hard for a lot of her clients to build a life.
How can you think about buying property, moving up in your job, if every 18 months they're having to think, you know, is this going to be redesignated? Is my work permit going to be granted in time? Am I going to have the over $500 per person to apply?
Still, it is life-changing for many people who don't have a safe home country to go back to and who otherwise couldn't be here and work legally, Norris says. But it's a Band-Aid, not a long-term solution. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Mortgage applications fell last week as the average interest rate on a 30-year mortgage hit 4.9%. That's from the Mortgage Bankers Association's weekly survey out today. And I'm going to put on my housing reporter hat now because this survey is just one of many indicators I'm watching all the time. There's existing home sales from the National Association of Realtors, housing starts and new home sales from the Census Bureau. Making sense of all these different data points can be daunting, so we're going to take a few minutes to talk about one of the big ones, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index. I know, it's a mouthful.
Yeah, nothing else has a name that long.
That is Craig Lazara with S&P Dow Jones Indices. It's the S&P part of that long name. Last week's release told us that home prices were up 19.2% year over year in January. Yeah, January was a while ago. I'll get to the lag in the data a bit later. But there's a reason we make a big deal about Case-Shiller. Most of the other home price indicators we talk about look at the mix of houses that sold in a given month or quarter or year. And there's a problem with that.
You know, if in one year the houses that sell are typically relatively small, two and three bedrooms, and the next year predominantly they're, you know, very large six and seven bedrooms with lots of land,
Okay, use your imagination here. Picture a bunch of modest bungalows and cottages on the market 1 year, but lots of fancy homes with big yards the next year.
Obviously, it's going to look like prices went up when maybe all that happened was the mix of product changed.
That's where two economists named Carl Case and Robert Shiller come in.
Chip Case and Bob Shiller, you know, have been thinking about this for a long time.
Okay, so Chip and Bob, a.k.a. Case and Shiller, were studying the housing market back in the 1980s.
People who knew him better than I did said Chip loved real estate. I mean, he would, you know, go to open houses on the weekend just to see what houses were doing. You know? And Bob is much more just a, you know, an academic economist. But they did this. They were interested. They did this as a way of understanding.
What Chip and Bob did is figure out how to control for that variability in quality and size and neighborhood from year to year by looking at repeat sales of the same houses.
The repeat sales mechanism is a way of adjusting for the mix of product so that you really are getting an apples to apples comparison.
The way you do that is by comparing the price of houses sold this year to the sale price of those same houses whenever they last changed ownership.
And then there's a certain amount of adjustment they have to do because if, you know, parents sell the house to the children, you probably don't want to count that one.
It's a lot of work. And that's one reason that Case-Shiller indices, there are actually several versions of them, have that 2-month lag. They're calculated on a 3-month rolling average. So the numbers we got last month in March were based on data from January of this year and November and December of last year.
This goes back just to when initially data was being collected, not electronically, but with, you know, just by person, it took longer, obviously, to collect that data, and it took longer to record the data.
That's Selma Hepp, deputy chief economist at CoreLogic. That's right, another company in that long name, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index. The ownership rights have been bought and sold a few times. Today, CoreLogic collects and compiles the data, while S&P distributes the indices. There's another reason they've had staying power.
It's one of the oldest ones, and, you know, people understand it very well. It's not like a black box.
Economists like to look at change over time, and the data goes back to the late 1980s. So even if it's not the most timely housing metric, it can tell meaningful stories, like the fact that single-family homes, adjusted for inflation, cost 75% more today than when the index started in 1987. Thanks again to Selma Hepp at CoreLogic and Craig Lazara at S&P. Coming up.
At best, the census was a D minus.
Oof, that hurts. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 144 points, 0.4%, to finish at 34,496. The NASDAQ was down 315 points, 2.2%, to close at 13,888. And the S&P 500 lost 43 points, 0.9%. To end at 4481. Intel slid 1.2% after suspending its operations in Russia. The company halted semiconductor shipments to customers in Russia and Belarus last month after the invasion of Ukraine. Looking at other businesses that have pulled out of Russia, Starbucks and American Express gave back 0.9%. McDonald's increased 1.1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We talked earlier about the new sanctions announced today aimed at Russian financial institutions and elites. Some U.S. lawmakers are also pushing for a ban on imports of Russian uranium. 16% of the uranium that fuels American nuclear power plants comes from Russia. If that ban comes to pass, the U.S. uranium industry sees an opportunity to ramp up domestic mining. Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports.
If we stopped importing Russian uranium, we'd need to get creative to replace it, says Dina Jokic, who studies nuclear energy at the University of Michigan.
There would be an initial need to pivot towards other sources, such as Canada and Australia.
Beyond that, she says some mining companies in the U.S. are standing ready to fill the gap.
It will be very, very expensive
to ramp up production at mines that have been sitting dormant. The industry is asking the federal government to start buying domestic uranium for a national reserve. Here's Scott Melby with the Uranium Producers of America at a recent Senate hearing.
The U.S. has ample uranium resources and the capacity to produce them at the highest environmental, safety, and health standards.
But some argue those standards aren't enough, like Amber Raimondo, energy director with the Grand Canyon Trust.
It's indigenous communities in the Southwest that disproportionately would pay that price.
Like the Havasupai tribe, whose reservation is at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Havasupai leaders have asked the Biden administration not to purchase uranium from the nearby Pinyon Plain mine.
It overlies a major aquifer that feeds Havasu Creek, the Havasupai's sole source of water.
And many indigenous communities are still reeling from the impacts of the last U.S. uranium boom, like the Navajo Nation, where the EPA says there are more than 500 abandoned mines.
And those uranium mines are from the 40s through the 60s. So that gives you a sense of the long-term impacts.
Andrew Curley is a professor at the University of Arizona and a citizen of the Navajo Nation. He says many U.S. uranium deposits sit on or near tribal lands, and the push to onshore production is a public health risk.
Replicating some of the past problems that we've been trying to address for the last half century.
Last year, Congress set aside $75 million to fund a national stockpile of domestic uranium. But so far, none of that money has been spent. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
A bidding war is underway in the airline industry. In February, the discount carriers Spirit and Frontier Airlines announced plans to merge. But now JetBlue has stepped in and wants to buy Spirit at a steep price of more than $3.5 billion. The deal, if approved, would make JetBlue and Spirit the fifth largest airline in the country. But are they a good fit? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
When one airline buys another, it's essentially gobbling up a bunch of resources that will help it grow fast. Henry Hardeveld is an analyst with Atmosphere Research Group.
Aircraft, routes, maybe access to a hub, and depending on the market, pilots and other employees.
And because all airlines kind of do the same thing, it may seem like any deal between two companies makes sense, as if comparing two airlines is like comparing apples and apples.
That's certainly the case with Spirit and Frontier.
Those are two budget airlines, apples.
JetBlue and Spirit are more like an apple and an orange coming together.
JetBlue is known for its brand name snacks and TVs on every seat. Spirit is all about cheap, no-frills flights. Customers pay extra for seat selection, drinks, and carry-on bags. And because of this, industry analyst Robert Mann says the two airlines have very little customer crossover, which means for JetBlue loyalists,
I think it would probably raise some eyebrows.
It could also raise eyebrows among employees. Jay Sorensen is president of IdeaWorks Company, an airline consulting firm. He says this is one of the trickiest parts of a merger.
Each company has its own culture in terms of its relationship with between management and the employees and the relationship between frontline employees and customers.
Then there are the time-consuming and expensive logistics, like aircraft overhauls and union issues. Safety regulations will have to be reevaluated and go through a lengthy clearing process. And whatever deal happens, Frontier and Spirit or JetBlue and Spirit could face antitrust scrutiny.
One of the things that the Department of Justice looks at is the overlap between two carriers.
JetBlue and Spirit have some, with a regional focus in the eastern part of the U.S. The DOJ might also look at how an acquisition could change the industry. And while this buyout could push flight prices lower across the board, it may raise Spirit's prices, narrowing the low-cost carrier space. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The decennial census feels very 2020 at this point, something that happened in a year we'd all like to forget. But last month, the Census Bureau released something that forced us to look back. Its best guess as to how accurate the once-a-decade count of every American actually was. The good news, officials say the overall count of roughly 331,449,000 people was pretty spot on. The bad news, the Bureau says it yet again undercounted certain demographic groups, including Black, Hispanic, and Native American people, while overcounting white and Asian populations. And that, as Marketplace's Matt Levin explains, will have economic ripple effects.
If you go to the census website right now, you'll see New Orleans had 383,997 people in 2020. That number affects political redistricting. It affects how public health experts estimate COVID rates. It's the number fourth graders lift from Wikipedia for their geography homework. And it's a number Mark Morial thinks is just wrong.
I think there's an undercount. I'm going to guess that's between 10 and 20%.
Morial is president of the National Urban League. He was also mayor of New Orleans during the 2000 census. He says while the last 20 years have seen more and better data in just about every other facet of life, the census is still struggling to count his city. And it's mostly because 60% of New Orleans is Black.
At best, the census was a D minus. And the reason it was a D minus is because the substantial undercount of Black and Brown communities should be unacceptable for a modern democracy.
Morial knows firsthand how the undercount can mess up local economies. When he was mayor, he tried to lure more grocery stores to parts of New Orleans considered food deserts.
If a grocery store developer chain looks at a neighborhood and says, don't know if there's enough of a customer base there, it leads to disinvestment.
There are a lot of factors at play. Renters are harder to count than homeowners, and African Americans are disproportionately renters. And there's a well-founded mistrust of the federal government rooted in centuries of racism. Throw in a pandemic, natural disasters, and interference from the Trump administration, and it's not surprising 2020 saw yet another undercount. The problem is that 2020 undercount isn't just a 2020 problem. Allison Plyer is chief demographer with the Data Center, which analyzes data in Southeast Louisiana.
The once every 10-year census, it is the foundational bedrock for all the statistics we track, including unemployment, jobs, poverty, housing costs, etc.
Census releases the American Community Survey every year. That's the more detailed data set that influences how $600 billion in public dollars gets distributed. The Census Bureau will make tweaks to make those numbers more reliable, but Plyer wishes it would use local data like utility records to improve the estimates.
This is something that they've done historically. They did in the 70s and 80s, but then for cost concerns, they narrowed that.
While the African-American undercount wasn't worse than in 2010, the undercount of Latinos was. The Trump administration tried to put a citizenship question on the census, and that didn't help. C. Leroy Cavazos-Reyna is with the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
People of color and minorities especially were afraid of giving their information to the government.
Cavazos-Reyna says the good news is the private sector has much more data than it had 20 years ago to measure Latino communities, especially as consumers. But the bad news?
By having an undercount, a lot of private sector companies could determine not to go to a community based on the availability of skilled workers there.
The Urban League and other advocacy groups are pushing for more avenues for local governments to challenge their census numbers. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, one victim of the ongoing supply chain issues is the National Weather Service. The New York Times reports that the service has cut back the frequency of its weather balloon launches due to shortages of helium and a contract issue with a hydrogen supplier. As quaint as it may sound, forecasters still use balloons to measure pressure, temperature, and relative humidity in the atmosphere. Typically, almost 100 balloons are launched twice a day from locations around the country. All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context. A little bookend from those Fed minutes, which gave some insight into how officials were thinking about the war in Ukraine back in mid-March. And it came up a lot. Here's a quote. Participants recognized that the invasion of Ukraine by Russia was causing tremendous human and economic hardship for the Ukrainian people. They judged that the implications of the war for the U.S. economy were highly uncertain, but in the near term, the invasion and related events were likely to create significant additional upward pressure on inflation and could weigh on economic activity. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.